Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 25th of August 2018. This is episode 3 of a podcast, and of course I'm doing, as people will know if they're listening, doing cardiac rehab, and you've listened to me do 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, then I'm getting up to an hour, and then what I'm doing is just trying to do several hours, several goes in one hit, and try and get a sort of a podcast sequence done in a day or half a day. I mightn't get there. Yeah, really essentially, New Scientist has been with me all the way through. So initially, when I was first out, I could only just read, just physically, not read a podcast, but only physically read half an article. And so I'm slowly been building up to it, and doing out the cognitive exercises there. Explain a bit more here. I'm also learning things. I have to go back and check some various chemicals I want to look at. Goodbye Cash is an article here. So this is episode 3. Banks, byline, banks and governments are toying with killing off physical money. But that not might be such a good idea, says Joshua Haugego. When Marco Polo visited Kublai Khan at the end of the 13th century, little seems to have impressed him more than that Khan used paper money. In this city, Kambaloo is in the mint of the great Khan, who may truly be said to possess the secret of alchemists, as he has the art of producing money, he wrote. It isn't hard to see why it seemed that way. To Europeans of the time, money consisted of things such as silver, gold coins that had intrinsic tradable worth. Khan simply took common old bark from mulberry trees, pulped it into paper, and then, with an array of signatures and seals, declared that it had value. No one in the Mongol Empire dared refuse this mean payment. Today, this idea is so central to our lives that it's hardly to spare a thought, but cash, physical money in the form of notes and coins, is losing lustre. The rise of internet shopping and increasing convenience of card payments, plus the extra cost for governments and central banks associated with cash, means all the talk is of taking money fully digital. The necessary technology already exists, but the dash away from cash gathers momentum. There are increasing rumblings from the downsides. Digital monies might not solve all problems of cash, and will bring a whole slew of new ones too. So do we want it? Victoria Cleland knows a thing or two about cash. Currently the Bank of England's Executive Director for Banking, Payments and Financial Resilience. She was until recently its chief cashier, meaning her signature appeared on all banknotes issued in England. Oh gosh, I've got a sore back. So I'm doing this reading while standing up now. Cash fulfills three crucial functions in the modern economies, she says. It's easily exchangeable from person to person. Everyone knows precisely what it's worth. And in normal economic circumstances, it barely changes from day to day. There's plenty of other tradable assets around, from gold bullion to diamonds to houses, but none fulfills all the functions as neatly as cash does. A whole complex financial system, including central banks, is built up around this. But the use of cash is in free fall. According to Trade Association UK Finance, fewer payments will be made with cash than by debit card in the UK for the first time in 2018. The proportion of cash payments in the UK dropped from 62% of transactions in 2006 to 40% in 2016, and projected to fall to just 21% in 2026. It's a similar story for the demonetization around the world as cards, mobile payment apps take over as a function of cash. That change has largely been driven by consumer convenience, but governments and central banks have their own reasons to think beyond cash. Coins and notes must be minted or printed in far greater quantities than are used at any one time to keep shops and retail banks and cash machines in stock. That leads to the paradox of cash. We are seeing a slowdown in cash use transactions, but we're still seeing an increase in demand for cash, says Cleland. Part of the problem is the rock bottom interest rates and the fear banks runs generated by a financial crisis a decade ago, which have okay, so there's a graph here showing that cash is dropping, and debit cards are increasing, and direct debit and faster payments of remote banking, basic direct credits, standing orders. Okay. May lead people to opt for stashing cash under the mattress. A survey commissioned by the Bank of England in 2014 found that 18% of people in the UK hoarded cash on an average of £345 each. Well, yeah, that's be my people just keeping coins. Well, that, although there is, that's the amount of money, that's probably twice as much you want. We have a few hundred dollars around. Beyond that, although there is already a flow of cash across borders into criminal enterprise and untaxed shadow economy, economists Friedrich Schneider and Colin Williams have estimated that the shadow economy counts between 8 to 24% of GDP in the rich world OECD countries, representing a serious drain on government coffers. Ending cash would help combat crime while also giving central banks more power to keep the economy moving, for example, by introducing negative interest rate. This is a de facto tax on money in banks is already in effect in Spain, Sweden, Denmark, Switzerland, and the Bank of England's chief economist, Andy Hallett, has called it an interesting solution. The idea is to encourage people to spend money when the economy is stagnating. Hoarding cash allows people to keep, to sidestep this stick. Oddly enough, its movements originally designed to topple conventional finance that spurred the talk of government-issued digital money. Digital cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoins were motivated by the desire to escape the whole banking system and centralize accounting control. Instead, they used distributed, supposedly unfalsified online ledgers known as blockchains, which rely on rigid mathematical rules to securely record transactions in the currency. This generates the same kind of trust in a transaction that cash issued and is backed by a central bank does. Now, central banks are considering how they might co-opt such a system for their own purposes. One of the furthest along the road is Swedish Riksbank, which floated the idea of a state-issued digital currency, e-krona, in 2016. Despite negative interest rates, cash use is falling unusually rapidly in Sweden. The proportion of cash payments declined from 39% to 13% in 2018. Around 60% of Swedes already use mobile apps called Swish, which allows people to instantly transfer money between different banks' accounts just by tapping a phone number. This is already just a user-friendly interface with the Swedish banking system's existing payment infrastructure called the e-krona, which could be a whole new currency. A report issued in late 2017, the Riksbank identified two possible ways of doing things. The first would be to provide bank accounts at the central bank in which people could keep digital currency, then have a centralized register of transactions between them, not unlike databases already used to process debit card transactions. The second would be a system by which encrypted digital files are exchanged between users, where the files themselves are declared to have value. Of Swedish authorities are very interested, said Bjorn Schendorf, a policy analyst at the Riksbank, seem a way to reach people without bank accounts. It seems one of the main headaches is making payments to unbanked people, and this might offer a solution. The bank asked for proposals from the tech companies on how to build e-krona, and having received 33 ideas, is continuing to discuss the options this year. Sweden isn't alone. In November 2017, Eurogrey published details of a small test of digital peso issued by the country's central bank. Venezuela has launched the Petro. Poor Venezuela. A cryptocurrency run by the state. Although the scheme is wildly derided, South Korea too plans to cashless by 2020 and has been mulling over launching a digital currency. But the latest signs are not that it will not, at least for now. One concern sounded by the country's central bank is how it would radically transform the banking system, potentially destabilizing it. Recently, there's a subtle difference between cash backed by central bank and the non-physical money that sits in your bank account. or that you use when you pay in plastic. Quote, when you're using a credit card or debit card, you're using money that's credited by a commercial bank, says Garrick, Plumman of Cambridge Centre of Alternative Finance in the UK. This money is either created by interest on loans made by the institution or by you when you make a deposit. Unlike with central bank cash, there's no hard and fast guarantee that you will get this money back. Commercial banks work on the assumption that not everyone will withdraw the money at once. If this happens, it can run out. For example, it happened to the collapsed UK Bank of North Rock in 2008. The fear of digital currencies could make the same sort of thing more likely. In times of crisis, people will pull their money from commercial banks to buy safe digital currency backed by the central bank, a potentially quicker way to undermine the banking system, by making it much better than banks. People can suddenly do it. As the Bank of England's Marilyn Troll suggests in a paper of 2016, that could precipitate chaos. If commercial banks went out of business, there would be no one to provide loans. There are many ways around that, such as allowing commercial banks to offer better interest rates than central banks. But this is uncharted territory. The Bank of England's researchers are still trying to work out what the effects might be. Quote, this is a big reason why the bank is backed away from issuing a central bank digital currency to everyday people, says Hillman. Clearman confirms that although the bank is monitoring the situation, it has no immediate plans to introduce a digital currency. It, however, is testing whether technology that underlies it could be used to speed up international financing transactions. There are other reasons for skepticism about digital money too. While the cashless economy might stop people shuffling cash under mattresses, hoarding in hard currency isn't itself morally wrong, and stopping it undermines honest people's right to choose to do what they do with their money. Critics suggest that criminals would simply switch to another form of cash currency or tradable assets such as gold. Brett Scott, author of The Hectic's Guide to Global Finance, has written about the time he was due to speak at a conference on reinventing money when he got a drink from a card-only vending machine only to have the plastic denied. His point is that cash transactions take place between two parties, where the digital transaction inevitably involved a third party facilitators currently. These have private credit and debit card firms such as Visa and MasterCard. Not only do these firms make a profit on the back of your payments, they also choose not to offer their services to certain clients. If we were able to totally replace cash, physical cash, with digital cash, we'd be giving similar power to state authorities on any other third party that might franchise their operations out to. And whatever controls your digital currency potentially has access to a huge amount of information about you, your finances, your habits. Questionable transactions. That doesn't have to be a bad thing, says Tom Bomfield, the founder of Monzo, a recently founded mobile-only bank in the UK. Monzo already crunches data to offer customers insights into their spending habits. For example, automatically label payments made by one bank's credit card, groceries, or eating out, and flashing them up on the customer's phone. He says there's about 30 financial issues, from switching energy providers to renewing insurance policies, where such a data-driven approach would help, with the proviso that people are clear that they are getting into when they sign up. Quote, I don't want to use the word F, the F word, Facebook, says Bonville, but they don't do enough proactive stuff. Others are less sanguine. If one driver at the end of the cash is to desire the control of flow of money more and reduce questionable transaction, that implies a degree of insight into the nature of transactions. Even the best intentions are safeguards in place. The question is whether having a lot more sensitive data sloshing around the digital realm can ever be a good thing. Quote, there's been a lot of said about the decline of cash, but there's not nearly enough as much discussion about data privacy and what that would mean. Potentially to go to a world completely known transactions where there's no anonymity and no privacy, says Hillman. Then there's the question of infrastructure reliability. Imagine a completely electronic payment system, no cash. Imagine this cyber attack and people can't transact. That would be catastrophic. There would be chaos in the streets. Such problems exist to be solved, but mean that we probably shouldn't anticipate the end of cash soon. Even critics bolt at that suggestion. Kenneth Rogoff, part of the economist who wrote a book, The Curse of Cash, with, among other things, strongly argues that cash oils the wheels of criminal underworld. Quote, "I don't make the case for going cashless," says Rogoff. "There's an inestimable value of being able to use cash in certain situations, including emergencies. Instead," he suggests, "phasing out only the most valuable banknotes, the £50 note in the UK and the $100 US bill. Perhaps that's the immediate future looks like, not cashless, but just less cash." Here's a sub-story called Really Swift for this article. International money transfers are a pain. Say someone in London wants to send money to someone in Singapore. Unlike within a country, there's no central money issuing authority to ensure that all funds there can be used. The UK bank must first send digital messages to the Bank of Singapore, instructing it that a transfer is going to happen using a system set up by the Belgium-based Society of World Interbank Financial Telecommunication, or SWIFT. Okay. Generally, it's anything but it taking at least 3 days to go through, because the first bank has no guarantees that the second bank will accept the transfer or how much it will cost. To pay the money, Singapore dollars, the recipient bank must take this from a holding place known as a Nastro account. Not just any bank can afford to maintain a well-stocked Nastro account, so not just any bank can take care of an international transfer. Even so, there are $5 trillion sitting in these accounts worldwide, which would be to put to better use. Shared ledger technology, or sort of cryptocurrencies used, could be the answer. In 2017, the Bank of England set up an experiment in which money was transferred between two simulated accounts in different countries using the Interledger Protocol, an open-source shared ledger system invented by a firm named Ripple. Instead of 3 days, the necessary checks and payments happened in seconds. Quote, "We're really excited about this," says Ripple Marcus Tricher, adding that he's talking to other central banks too. None is using the technology for real yet, but we'll be very close. Tricher thinks payment systems are in the era akin to how business was pre-internet, connecting things up and opens up new opportunities. Culture. The Deep Blue Grayed Out. It's an eye-popping show of marine anatomy, but Summit Paul Chowdhury longs to dive deeper. So this is a review. Sea creatures at the RH Lawrence Hall, London, 30th August, and then to Edinburgh. So this is a review of a show. The 3-ton corpse of Hei Ho, the baby mink whale beached in the Chinese island in 2009, was rotting by the time scientists reached it. Undeterred, a team of around 30 autonomists swung into action, labouring for nearly 2 years to preserve, dehydrate, plastinate it, before reassembling it into to reveal the muscles on one side and the nerves and organs on the other. Now, Hei Ho, the world's largest plastinated marine animal, is the star of the Sea Creatures, an exhibition of more than 50 similarly preserved aquatic animals that will be touring the UK over the next few months. His companions include sharks, mantle rays, porpoises, giant squid, ocean dwellers ranging from crab, scuttlefish, and represented as well by 150 individual body parts. Only fish market serves up a visual banquet to aquatic viscera, fresh from the sea to boot. But when the sea's charismatic megafauna are preserved for our delectation, we seek assurances that they are being served up with respect and not merely to sate our more ghoulish appetites. A concern that has lingered over the plastication spectators for decades here, the plastication of bodies, largely thanks to the exhibition of human cadavers staged by the techniques inventor Gunther von Hagens. What a fantastic story. Education value is usually the fig leaf held up against the charges of indecencies. I love that. Beautifully. It's indecent. Here's a fig leaf. Secrets is presented by former associate of Von Haken stresses the exhibits have been ethically sourced, although Hal Hay is the only specimen whose provenance is described. The curation is generally sound. The section devoted to the flamboyant, a starring sailfish, and the humble, the cabinet of shellfish. There are idiosyncrasies. A salami slice penguin is not a sequitur in the area of otherwise devoted to invertebrates. The whales have got a vertebrates. Oh yes, okay. There's a section. And the show's few winceworthy grotesque seems inadvertent rather than designed. Another penguin grinning manically as it opens its skin, a porpoise split like a banana. Credibility comes from the partnership with the Scots Association for Marine Science, which has provided crisply informative labels describing the anatomies and behaviours of the animals on display. The presentation of body parts works well. The material facts of Cruscan carp's pea-sized brain makes its ability to learn from experience all the more striking. Everyone knows what gills look like from the outside, but their corsetry, window-free with from flesh, is a different matter. And a shark's stomach turns out to be a surprisingly small but intensely corrugated, as the surface area is not volume that counts when it comes to digestion. With complete specimens, however, there's little to help the viewers understand what they're looking at. There aren't any explanatory diagrams or even illustrations of the animals as they might be appeared in life. The show's companion smartphone app does offer some medium, but it's more entertaining than informative. Plus, the nation can use colours to add visual appeal and highlight certain tissues. It also allows for poses, both naturalistic and contrived. Attributes used to spectacular effect on animals inside out exhibition in London National History Museum in 2012. An example here. For example, here though, the subject's stiff poses and bleached appearance give no hint of elegant motion or vibrant colours we associate with marine life. Once the initial shock and awe of seeing a whale's shark's innards has passed, my reaction to the parade of bloodless guts was mounting in Nui. Without contextual information, age, sex, locality, single feature, circumstance of death and collection, I found it hard to remember what this monochrome tableau is made up of remarkable animals, remarkably preserved, rather than waxworks in a slightly past museum. Sea creatures may offer sufficient gawping opportunities to satisfy those who just want to gaze, graze the surface of marine biology, but it's likely to frustrate those who would like to dive more deeply. Okay, this is a review called 22 Minutes. We know a little about how emotions are made. Emotional Beings, a book here. Neuroscience of Emotions, a new synthesis by Ralph Adolphs and David J. Anderson from Princeton University Press. If you struggle to define your innermost feelings of love, lust, anger, and jealousy, you're not alone. Scientists are especially sloppy, sometimes referring to emotions as feelings, and at other times referring to internal states as behaviour, which is just one of the reasons Ralph Adolphs and David Anderson have created a new framework for study of the emotion across the species. The neuroscience of emotion is the two Caltech professors sift through the current studies of emotion and provide a roadmap for the future. The analysis is authoritative and unsurpassed in its intricate examination of the field. It also is fluent, but don't expect a frolic. This is a commanding textbook for scientists and students. The book may be of interest to lay readers, but most will struggle, unless multivariate analysis and representative geometry is your thing. The earlier chapters are about what we don't know and what we consistently get wrong. An in-depth view of our ignorance, in which authors imply we know almost nothing about how our brain produces emotion. This criticism continues throughout the book. I imagine scientists despairingly overcome by futility of their past work and the enormity of future endeavours. Light relief comes through the famous historical cases, including Phineas Cage, a railway worker whose behaviour changed after an iron pole blasted through his brain, and the SM, and SM, a woman whose rare brain lesion left her with little or no capacity to express fear. That's really interesting. a lot of workers in Australia have nail guns through their head. The nail gun fires through the head, and the nail gun's supposed to actually go into wood quite smooth without shattering it. So it also means that a nail gun goes through the head. As the book progresses, it gets less easy to read, with Adolf and Addison moving from how to understand the basic properties of emotion to tools used to study animals and humans. It ends by an elevating current of theories and running through questions with still to be answered. It's clear that understanding emotions will take a group effort. Emotions is the emergent property of a complex system of molecules, cells, surface networks and entire brains, says the author. Since we don't yet know the best level at which to understand it, a science of emotion must be cumulative, with all the levels studied in parallel. Part of the problem is that emotions are not material phenomena. The amygdala, for example, is often associated with fear. We can cut it out and impair someone's forms of fear, but put one in a dish, stimulate it as much as you like, it would still be absurd to claim you're causing a state of fear. As the author says, insofar as the amygdala generates fear, it can do so only with a complex network of other brain structures. I'm interested in reading about how the sleep cycle works with the amygdala. And the eye cells, light cells, go back there. The book is best thought, at its best, a thought experiment, try decoupling the word emotion from the word conscious experience of emotion. Everyday usage assume conscious experience, but science of emotion need not. In non-conscious emotion possible, in animals, humans, and even robots. Oh, is it? Antonio Damso, one of the former scientists in the field, calls it an indispensable book. For student scientists willing to invest serious effort, I agree, but readers who want to learn of how we use feelings to construct ourselves might feel more at home with Damso's book, The Strange Order of Things. Culture Searching for Sandra. What if AI's assistants aren't as artificial as they seem? Sarah Leach enjoys a new podcast. So this is a podcast, better than my podcast for sure. How do we really know who's at the other end of conversations with digital assistants like Siri and Alexa? Just who's listening to our requests and questions or assessing our latest troves of personal information we're given over to these companies? And does the kind of access affect both those handing over their details and the employees on the other end? The podcast Sandra weaves these debates about ethics into a technology, into an engaging audio drama. The premise of the show is that a woman, Helen, played by Alicia Shawkat, takes a job in which she pretends to be a virtual assistant named Sandra, voiced mechanically by Kristen Wiig, which has been created by a tech company called Orbital Teledynamics. All the Sandras, as the company names the humans it pays to pretend to be artificial intelligences, are assigned specialized topics to cover. To Helen's confusion, she's assigned birds, but other Sandras she meets specialize in everything from Enlightenment philosophers to movies starring Morgan Freeman. She quickly finds that while her personal life is a mess, as Sandra, she can solve any problems by buying doves for a pagan wedding to picking a canary wallpaper for a nursery. Early on, she and her supervisor, Dustin, played by Ethan Hawke, bond over her love of being Sandra, describing it as a superpower. Yet it is a fairly unusual when superpowers are involved. Wielding them is nothing like as simple as it first appears. Dustin tells Helen to trust the system, reassuring her that Orbital wouldn't put her in a situation it didn't think she could handle. But she hits both the highs and lows as she asks questions to put to her users. While the idea of human pretending to be AI may sound a little bit of a stretch, it's actually a real phenomenon. From startups to established outfits, companies have rolled out AI tools that later turn out to be powered by human intelligence, where some people did everything from chatting with customers to transcribing personal information, such as receipts. Humans performing the task are often bored and frustrated to the point of saying that they are looking forward to being replaced by machines. And the humans interacting with the pseudo-AI have had to resort to developing their own tests to figure out whether they are really talking to a human or a machine. All this is part of a bigger picture among tech companies. For many years, it has been acceptable to roll out unfinished products and reel in investors over in hauled, overstating products' capabilities, that is, vaporware. It used to be done in the photonics boom. This is a strategy that has, and also Edison with his light bulb. This is a strategy that has been seen companies like the Theranos, which makes false claims about blood testing technology in order to raise millions of dollars from investors. Sandra also picks up another interesting trend in AI, something that one of the attractions of the technology. People interact very differently than they do with other people. For example, when US military used AI therapists to screen homecoming servicemen personnel for post-traumatic disorder, they found that it was more effective at getting people to discuss their symptoms honestly than either human or written questionnaires, human interview. The customers in the show ask Helen and her fellow Sandra's questions they probably wouldn't dream of asking another person, like whether it's possible to get an allergy from just thinking about a food. But when they also contact her, just to have someone to talk to, or in one case to have someone for their parrot to talk to. Surprisingly, some of the humans that Helen talks to as Sandra aren't being straightforward about who they are and what they want either. Some do it to abuse her, a pattern we see when humans interact with AI in the real world. Others turn out to be doing it more for duplicitous reasons with more serious consequences. What does Sandra have to say about the world? And this will be an incredibly boring podcast, I suppose. What does Sandra have to say about the world that is full of AIs pretending to be humans and the humans pretending to be AIs? Well, you will have to listen to the whole show to find out. But it comes down to this. Sooner or later, your lies will catch up with you, whether you're human, an AI, or something in between. Last word, load of rubbish. Rubbish collection seems complicated these days. Where I live, so this is the last word, this is where readers are asking with their questions, and the questions are put out to other readers, and other readers can do it. Rubbish collection seems complicated these days. Where I live, I use 5 different bins for the collections fortnightly. Unlike many people, I observe I squash things like aluminium cans and plastic milk bottles. It seems logical that it reduces the volume of rubbish stored in the house, but does doing so help any recycling? Most material recoveries use conveyor belts. This is the answer. First, magnets detect metals, but then remaining materials are processed by shape. Oh dear, that's not quite true. They use inductive levitation. Flat things are considered to be cardboard. 3D objects are glass, which smashes, plastic or aluminium. The metal isn't magnetic, but it can be separated using electrical air currents induced by a magnetic field. Very fat atoms will not make it to this short sort of stage. So flattening cans and plastic bottles can lead to the process cardboard rather than materials they are. Sophisticated material recovery facilities use lasers, weight and buoyancy to separate materials, but these are not common paste. The most beneficial is to wash your items. Any smell in the bin is likely to be food remnants, not aluminium or plastic, and never put plastic bags in recycling unless you live in one of the few areas that deal with them. So he's in Australia. There you go. So don't squash things. Isn't that amazing? In the 1970s, I worked on a large hospital. In order to reduce the space that waste took up, the management bought a compactor to reduce the bales. But the idea was short-lived because the first collection was declined. The refuse form also had compactors. Already compacted waste gave its compactors indigestion. And that's, okay, most collection fears rubbish to rubbish as they go along. That's the last answer. Dessal Hazel. Our bright lights that cyclists now use safe for the eyes of onlookers. Many people permanently damage their eyesight by looking at the sun through binoculars. Damage done by light, by but by the heat of the infrared radiation of the sun's rays. The lens of the eye focuses both visible light and visible heat on the light-sensitive cells at the back of the eye. The heat is so strong the cells overheat and get damaged. Bright LEDs used by cyclists are LEDs and produce a lot of light but almost no heat, so having them shine won't damage your cells. However, it doesn't mean the experience is risk-free. The iris expands and contracts to alter the amount of light through the eye and the pupil. If it contracts quickly on exposure to bright light, but expands slowly when the light is removed, night vision in humans occur when the iris is dilated and the back cells have adapted to low light, which is visual purple. It can take a long time to establish, but it can suddenly be lost with a flash of bright light. If it happens, visible things become invisible, and the risk of bumping into things grows. The effect is sometimes manipulated in nighttime orienteering, where it is important to retain night vision by running ahead and reading a compass and map. Incidents suggest that people try to secure an unfair advantage by switching on their LED headbands 15 seconds before they start and turning around, dazing many competitors as possible. Combat this, some people wear dark glasses with side shield only to take them off the start or carry a mirror. Okay, so this is, you also have to understand about visual purple produced by the eye to increase night vision. When you step outdoors on a bright sunny day, you often experience the discomfort and partial brightness of your eyes adapt to illumination. Temporary brightness occurs when you walk indoors on a sunny day. Using exposure readings on your digital camera, I compare the illumination of a room with large windows to a shade inside my house with the outdoors on a bright sunny days. The outdoors scene is 400 times brighter. Looking at a LED reflector and light bulb, probably brighter than a bicycle, than a bicycle's, at a distance of 1 meter, it's that times brighter than my room. On a bright day, or 50th of the brightness of the outdoor scene, your eyes are in no danger from even the brightest bicycle light. It might appear painfully bright, but this is because you're usually looking at it with a dark, adapted eyes. In daylight, it would not be so bright. In fact, I can barely make out the spot of my powerful LED torch makes on a sunny wall. Thanks for listening. End of New Scientist. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.